As counsel are getting situated, I assume you're on State versus Kelly. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. You can be seated whenever you're ready. My name is John Rodenberg. With me is Chief Judge Cleary and Judge Stauber. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant wishes to use that time. It looks like you have an illustrative document there.
I do, Your Honor.
Is that something that was that's in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. It was a part of my addendum, and it's essentially an enlargement of an exhibit that was entered at the district.
That's that aerial photograph of the intersection?
Correct, Your Honor.
Was that received in evidence? I had a question about that when I was looking at the addendum.
Yes, I believe that it was Exhibit 2, Your Honor.
Exhibit 2? Okay.
And again, I think I noted in my addendum that it may not have been that exact picture itself, but it was a very similar Google aerial image of the intersection.
Just a minute here. Let me find Exhibit 2.
And, Your Honor, I would not object to it. I think it would be
okay. Well, that solved the problem. Thank you. As you approach the podium, each of you give us your name and the party you represent so that we've got that for the recording. Again, 15, 15, and 5. Whenever appellant is ready, you may proceed.
Thank you, Judge.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Justin Duffy. I'm an attorney with the law office of John Lunig, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Anthony Kelly. Your Honors, the issue here is whether the left turn that was conducted by Mr. Kelly violated Minnesota Statute 169.19, Subdivision 1, parens B, and thus provided a legal basis for the stop of his vehicle due to the violation of that traffic law. This issue turns on a question of statutory interpretation, and that is whether Minnesota law dictates which lane a left-hand turn must be completed in. The state contends that the law requires a turn into the near lane when completing a left-hand turn. However, that argument is entirely without merit because the left turn statute simply does not dictate which lane that a turn must be completed in.
Well, it's true in part, is it? But Subdivision 19 does reference whenever practicable the left turn shall be made in that portion, et cetera. Does it not?
It does, Your Honor.
Isn't that some guidance from the statute as to what is expected?
It is, Your Honor, but that portion of the statute doesn't actually dictate which lane that a turn is to be completed in. What that provision of the statute is speaking to is how cars are to proceed through the intersection itself. If you look,
I know that's your argument, but it doesn't say, whenever practicable, the left turn should be made in that portion of the intersection to the left of the center of the intersection. Now, you're saying it ends in the intersection, when another reading could mean that is the turn into the lane, right?
Yes, I would disagree with argument that would extend beyond the area that constitutes the intersection in a situation like this.
Because of the statutory description of intersection.
Correct, Your Honor. So in looking and just jumping to that provision right away, because that's obviously what the big debate was about at the lower court and what that means. So again, whenever practicable, the left turn shall be made in that portion of the intersection to the left of the center of the intersection. And at least for me personally, it had helped to actually, you know, look at the intersection in question while discussing this. So in this case, Mr. Kelly was traveling westbound on Singletree Lane. He was in this lane, the left lane from his perspective, and intended to make a turn onto southbound Prairie Center Drive. Now, as you can see here, there are two southbound lanes in this area of Prairie Center Drive. He was stopped at this light, and when it turned green, he proceeded to enter the intersection and then completed his turn by entering into the far lane rather than entering into the near lane. And as it pertains to that final sentence of the applicable statute itself, again, term that they're using there is intersection. And as defined in statute, the intersection is merely this square area right here. So that provision has nothing to do with how the turn should be completed. It's simply dictating how a vehicle is to move when it's within the square area that constitutes the intersection. And essentially
so it's your interpretation of the last sentence then that the driver should get to the left of the center of that intersection as soon as possible.
Correct, Your Honor. And in thinking about just your everyday life and driving, if you have a vehicle here where Mr. Kelly was attempting to make a left-hand turn, and you have a vehicle here attempting to make a left-hand turn at the same time, as is often the case, by requiring vehicles to move to that portion of the intersection that's to the left of the center, so if this is the center of the intersection here, by requiring them to move to the left of the center, it avoids the vehicles from colliding in the center.
But it puts them right in the line of the vehicles passing through the intersection, and is contrary to the way Mr. Pileski taught me to make left-hand turns.
And are you saying, Your Honor, that the better practice would be to make a strict 90-degree angle on your turn?
Or stay out to the in your correct lane, the extension of your correct lane, until you actually do the turn.
Okay.
To not drift over through two oncoming lanes of traffic as you're doing your turn to a greater extent than practicable.
Well, Your Honor, obviously you have to heed other rules of the road. I mean, when you're conducting a left-hand turn, I'm not saying that the statute's instructing people to go wherever they want in the intersection. Obviously, if you're making a left-hand turn, you have to avoid other cars that might be traveling straight through this intersection.
Well, here, I need to picture this again in my head. So you're suggesting the statute is limited to the intersection, that practical portion of it?
Correct.
Which is saying that you are to the left as you're making your turn. You're to hug the left, essentially. Do you agree with that? In the intersection.
I don't want to say hug the left, but use the left portion of the...
Right. And then you're suggesting that you can, as long as you do that, you can keep going and get into the far right lane rather than the other lane.
Correct, Your Honor.
Thereby, perhaps, getting right in front of a car to your right that is also making the turn.
That could potentially happen, yes.
Okay. And you think that's allowable. Do you think the battle case...
Just a minute. I want to follow up on Chief Judge Cleary's question. A car to the right of you shouldn't be making a left-hand turn because he's not turning from the lane that's the leftmost lane.
Sure he is. He's just also turning. But he's turning to the far right lane.
Cleary, I believe I misunderstood your question. So you're saying...
Okay, let me stop
for
a minute.
Here,
you got two cars going into the intersection, taking a left. And then they're going to go like this. Okay. So if your car keeps going straight, it's going to run straight smack into the one that's coming, also taking a left, going to the far lane.
Yes. With that clarification, Your Honor, I believe it depends on the circumstances of the specific case. In this case, a left turn can only be made from this left lane of single tree lane.
Because of the first sentence of the statute.
Correct. There are areas, there are roadways where two cars can make a left turn, but that has to be specifically designated on that particular roadway. The general rule applies here.
I understand
that there is only one lane from which he can make a left-hand turn. And when that is the case, it does not matter which lane you enter into. That's my argument. Obviously, if you could make a left-hand turn from this lane, then you might have an issue with an illegal change of course. However, here we're going from one lane where it's legal to make a turn into a roadway that contains two lanes.
I understand now. And I was referencing the double intersection where you can turn left. Judge Wall referenced Battle versus Commissioner of Public Safety. Do you take issue with that case?
I do, Your Honor. One, Battle was unpublished and thus is not precedential.
I know it's not precedential, but...
And more importantly, it's entirely unpersuasive because it does not address the issue that we're dealing with here today. In Battle, it appears as though, in the one paragraph where they discussed that case, it appears as though Mr. Battle had conceded to the interpretation, but instead he sought a remand to determine whether or not his movement in that case was practicable. That's not what we're seeking here. We're actually challenging the interpretation of this particular statute, because based on our reading of it, there is no mandate as to where a left turn is to be completed. And I also think it's an interesting aside in Battle, based on his collateral estoppel argument, that it would seem as though in the criminal case, the district court judge that ruled or presided over that matter may have sided with his argument that his turn was not illegal in any way, shape, or form. I think that the right turn statute provides some interesting context and guidance for our analysis of this left turn statute, because in the right turn statute, there's an explicit provision that requires that turn shall be made as close as practicable to the right-hand curb or edge of the roadway. And what that tells us is that the legislature knows how to dictate the manner in which a turn should be completed, but they simply did not include that sort of language in the left turn statute, and that shows us the presumption is that they purposely omitted that language, that they chose not to include that. And the state contends that a left-hand turn doesn't contain or doesn't have similar points of reference for mandating something, but it would have been as simple as adding a line that says something to the effect of a left-hand turn shall be completed in the lane nearest the center line on the roadway being entered. However, they didn't do that, or they could have had something similar to the approach language stating that the left turn shall be completed in the right portion of the roadway being entered nearest the center line thereof. It would have been very simple for them to mandate how the turn is to be completed, but they simply didn't. It is only in looking at the first sentence of the applicable statute here, the left-hand turn statute, it is only the second clause of that sentence that actually addresses how a left-hand turn is to be completed. And all it states is that the left turn shall be made so as to leave the intersection to the right of the center line of the roadway being entered. Again, the
which in the case of the divided road like you've got is anywhere to the right of that center island.
Correct, Your Honor. So this has a grass median here which constitutes our center line. Anywhere to the right of the center line satisfies the statute, near or far lane. And again, the fact that they use the phrase roadway being entered, I think is key in this analysis. They didn't use the phrase intersection as was used in the final sentence of this clause, and this is the only portion of the statute that actually dictates travel on the roadway being entered rather than within the statutorily defined area that constitutes the intersection. And I would note, too, that the state agrees that Mr. Kelly complied with the first sentence of this provision, that his approach for the right hand, or the left-hand turn was appropriate, and that he left the intersection to the right of the center line. And again,
and apparently was signaling.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
And apparently was signaling.
Correct, Your Honor. He was stopped at the intersection and signaling his left-hand turn. And the officer made clear that he felt that Mr. Kelly should have turned into the near lane and then signaled his intent to move over to the far lane, and that it was based on that supposed traffic violation. That's the only reason that he had pulled him over that day.
And as I understand that, I haven't looked at the transcript for a few days now, but as I recall it, he was going to turn right off of the roadway onto which he just had turned left because he was going to go somewhere else.
Correct, Your Honor. So if this map were to continue, there is a right-hand turn lane that starts immediately right here, and there's another intersection not far down the road. He then proceeded to take a right.
And he signaled that turn.
Yep, and he signaled his lane change into that turning lane and then properly left his signal on to indicate his right turn onto Columbine Road, which he then made. And so the only issue the officer had was the fact that he turned and entered into the far lane rather than entering into the near lane.
And as I read his testimony, again, it's been a few days, but the officer didn't testify that he turned first into the left lane and then switched lanes without signaling. He didn't say that.
Correct, Your Honor.
He just turned straight into the right lane.
Correct, Your Honor. He turned straight into the far lane.
There's no claimed violation of the separate subdivision that says if you're going to change lanes, you have to signal.
I'm sorry, say that again.
There's no claim. The officer didn't claim a violation of the separate subdivision that requires a signal to indicate a change of lane.
In some weird fashion, he did. But I believe that once that was clarified down at the district court level, that essentially he was stating that he felt the proper practice would be to turn into the near lane and then signal his intent to move into the next lane.
Right. That's what I think I'm on your side on this question. On this small question, he didn't claim that there was a turn into the left lane followed by a move into the right lane without a signal.
Yes.
Instead, he contended that there was a move into the right lane initially, followed by a right-hand turn signal to make a turn, which in your view, that's the question in the case, is not a violation.
Correct, Your Honor. Correct.
Counsel, I just want to follow up for a minute here quickly. In the scenario, and I realize this intersection is not that scenario, but in a scenario when two lanes can turn, in reading that statute, how would you read that when two cars are turning, taking a left onto a two-laner? How would you read that statute? Well, could the car on the left just keep going and go into the right-hand lane? Do you know what I'm saying?
No, I don't think they could under that situation because there's a provision, I want to say it's parens F, that allows local cities or the Traffic Highway Department to create by way of marking or other indication two left-hand turn lanes, and that would supersede the general statute that we're dealing with here today. And at that point, you often see, when they have two left-hand turns lanes, a dashed line that follows along and guides people as to what their lane is. And I believe that in that circumstance, when you have those two lanes, a move from the inside lane to the far lane in the course of that turn would constitute a lane change. I guess I'm not saying that it's exactly barred, but I think at that point you're actually changing a lane and may need to signal your intent to do so, because that's actually a lane. Whereas here, we're going from one lane onto a road that has two lanes, and there's no need to signal your intent in determining which lane you're going to enter.
Okay.
In conclusion, Your Honors, the statutory language here is clear and unambiguous and simply doesn't dictate which lane that a left turn must be completed in. And because Mr. Kelly's turn complied with all of the applicable provisions of the statute, there was no particular or objective basis for his stop. And because of that, and because of the fact that the parties agreed that this pretrial issue was dispositive, the only result that can come from this is reversal of the lower court's ruling, suppression of the evidence, and vacation of his conviction. And if there are no other questions, I will conclude there.
Any other questions? And Judge Stauber, any other questions? I want to leave you with a thought we can address on rebuttal, but I first want to make sure I've got the right case. There was a Supreme Court case a couple of years ago out of North Carolina, I want to say Hain, that an officer stopping a vehicle under a mistaken interpretation of the law can nevertheless be okay if it's a mistake of law. Minnesota law generally allows mistakes only in mistake of fact. This seems like a mistake of law. Does the North Carolina case change that at all? But I'll just leave you with that thought.
Thank you, Your Honor. We can pick that up on rebuttal.
Respondent?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Jesse Berglund for the state. I represent the city of Eden Prairie in this case.
Counsel, do you know the answer to Judge Rodenberg's last point?
I do not, Your Honor. Okay. I'm not familiar with that case.
The case is Heien, H-E-I-E-N, versus North Carolina, from 2014.
And I additionally rely on the precedent in Minnesota, Your Honors, that a mistake of law of the officer usually cannot be a basis for a
arguing
in this case. So I would not argue.
You don't argue with the Minnesota distinction between mistakes of law and fact?
No, I don't, Your Honor.
Okay, good. So, you've dispensed with that, and counsel doesn't need to worry about it anymore.
So as an illustrative point, I would say not as much as you know, a valid legal or factual argument in regards to this case, but as illustrative of the issue before the court, when I was preparing for this hearing today, you know, talking with several people, you know, it was a matter of, well, what's a common understanding of the law and what do people actually do? And people generally who I talked to were like, yeah, you're supposed to turn into the closest lane, whether it's going right or going left. But then, well, do they always do it?
So and are we 60-40 or 70-30 or what?
I don't recall. I think most people said, you know, yeah, you're supposed to. But then when people actually do it, they're like, well, no, I mean, I think they would say I've on occasion, you know, when doing a right turn, went all the way over, or doing a left turn, went all the way over. So, again, illustrative.
But really here, if I read the officer's testimony correctly, in its entirety, the only thing that he says that occasioned the stop was the violation of that section, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
I mean, he didn't, as I was asking counsel for appellant, he doesn't say you violated some other lane change statute or that you went over onto the shoulder on the far right side, which is indicative of drunk people at 3 o'clock in the morning. There was none of that kind of stuff. There's just a statutory violation.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
So
no matter what Mr. Pileski taught me was the better way to do it isn't what we're really talking about.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think we're looking at the interpretation of this statute here. And I think the court has to look at it from, you know, two perspectives is, you know, applying this statute to this particular case as of on these particular facts, or coming up with broader directive in regards to this law as the legislature wrote it, which may be applicable to a broader discussion of how people are driving in general.
Or maybe we need more lawyers in the legislature, but that's another issue.
That's so true, Your Honor. So in looking at the findings of fact from the district court opinion, the district court, in regards to this particular issue, made two key findings of fact: that the vehicle entered the intersection and turned wide into the right lane, and that nothing obstructed the defendant's ability to pull into the left lane. The state is taking the position that on the unambiguous plain reading of the statute, that the statute would require the defendant in this particular occasion to pull into the nearest lane. And that would be relying on that and what the court did in Battle and what the court did in this particular case at the district court level, relying on that language whenever practicable. And that language, even if it doesn't direct when completing the turn into the roadway that you're entering, still does direct that to the left of the center of the intersection. And from the logical...
I'm confused about that interpretation of the last sentence. I'll tell you that. I'm confused. Mm-hmm. The whenever practicable part applies to the left turn shall be made in that portion of the intersection to the left of the center of the intersection. I have some problem with turning on an angle like that based on my training. But to the left of center of the intersection, if you're talking about the roadway and interpreting that as being what they were talking about, then you'd have them make their left turn into the wrong lane.
I don't believe that's so, Your Honor. I believe because the center of the intersection would be that square, which is the intersection, and that center mark. And when you're turning, to maintain left of that center point. And what I'm arguing is that if you are essentially changing lanes during your turn, you're putting yourself in a position where you're not going to be left of center of that intersection while doing so. And there are points where that might not be practicable. It may be a two-lane road.
It seems very possible to stay to the left of that point, if that's what it's talking about, and then still turn into either lane. That doesn't seem difficult at all, given that intersection.
Well, in perhaps this particular one, but I believe in general. I mean, there's so many ways
that we're talking about this particular one.
And that's the broader point, again, I'm getting at, Your Honor, is that if we're just looking at it from the particular facts of this case as opposed to a broader interpretation of this statute in general. And I think that's a key thing that this court has to distinguish when making its ruling on this case in particular is this relying on just these facts or looking at the broader statutory interpretation issue and pronouncing a broader policy interpretation of this and how every turn is conducted statewide in regards to the broad array of intersections we see in this state, which some may be concise like this with clear and relatively modern, some in some areas may be a little more twisted but still be constitute subject to the same law.
So your interpretation of center in that last sentence is a point, not a line.
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. And the reason for that, and if I may hold up the exhibit here, is if you are making this left turn here, the center point would be here. You are to maintain left of that because oftentimes if this is a stoplight, for example, both sides may have protected greens. And if there's another car coming from this direction, the point is to maintain left of center here to avoid oncoming traffic. That may also be doing a left turn from this other direction.
As previously noted with counsel for the appellant, it seems like that interpretation has you in the oncoming lane of traffic for the maximum amount of time, which seems to me to be very dangerous.
Being to the left?
Yes.
If you're to the right, I would say you're going to be in the oncoming lane of traffic.
No, the right, that guy's got to stay in his proper lane of traffic until it's safe, and you stay in yours until it's safe, and then make your turn as close as possible to 90 degrees.
Well, it's not saying you have to do it exactly 90 degrees. It just means that as you make that turn and make your arc, that it maintains to the center of that. And if you are going to the far right, you're more likely to then go then be to the right of center of that.
Was there any testimony here by anyone about where the turn, this particular turn, was executed in relation to the center point of the intersection?
There was not, Your Honor. I think the district court made the finding that the turn was wide. So the question at that point would be if the court does determine that there is some ambiguity there in the district court's finding, maybe misapplication of the law. As I wrote in my brief, I believe a proper remedy may be to remand it down to the district court to relook at that issue, make a finding of fact whether the court complied with that left of center interpretation when looking at this. So looking at this from the plain meaning, the state believes that that provision in regards to whenever practicable language would provide a basis for the court to rule in favor of the state. I would also note, even if there is some ambiguity in this, I believe that the language and surrounding language and the intent here that can be construed would still be in favor of the state. I'd first cite to that appellant talked about the related right turn statute, and I don't believe that that's applicable in this particular situation. And the reason is because of the myriad of ways that how roads cross will make it impossible for the legislature to actually dictate whether it's going to be a curb, whether it's going to be a median, whether it's going to be an island in between. A
now
lane
they could
divider
have added
line.
A sentence something like. Just to take a couple of seconds here to try and formulate an answer to that problem, it could have included another sentence that said a left-hand turn in the case of a multi-lane road shall be made into the leftmost lane of the intersecting roadway. It wouldn't be very hard.
You're right, Your Honor. They could have said that. They didn't say that, but I don't feel like how they phrase the right turn lane is applicable in this because we don't have a curb.
Yeah, it doesn't apply directly. There is no right. curb. But I think their argument is not that there's always a curb in the middle of a roadway, but rather that the legislature can, by making some indication, tell you where they want you to complete that turn. In the right-hand turn lane, it's near to the curb.
Right. Well, and I would agree with that, Your Honor. I think they could have been more detailed, but I still think, you know, in regards to the ambiguity that when the intent of the legislature here is, you know, looking at the occasion and necessity for the law, the mischief to be remedied, the object to be attained, again, is public safety, traffic control. And going back to the Bisonette case, which I cite in my brief, you know, public safety laws, petty misdemeanors are to be construed liberally to effectuate their purpose, which is the public safety on the roadways. And the mischief to be remedied is the orderly flow of traffic to prevent collisions. Essentially, under a situation of a vehicle not being required to move to make that turn into the closest lane, you're creating a higher likelihood of vehicle collisions. Oftentimes, from the oncoming lane, vehicles are allowed to make right turns as well. And what you have a situation is essentially is a vehicle changing lanes during its turn, essentially could then be putting themselves in the position to impact a vehicle making a lawful right turn at the same time into what would that be their closest lane. So I believe that's what the legislature intended to remedy here by putting this provision in place to avoid the oncoming traffic. And
that certainly collision. Makes good sense to me. And that was, as I say, that was the way I was taught to make left-hand turns, was to turn into the lane you're talking about. But there's no dispute here, is there, that when Mr. Kelly left the intersection, he did so to the right of the center line of the roadway being entered.
There's no dispute, Your Honor.
You just say he was too far to the right of the roadway being entered.
Essentially by being in another lane. Over. And that would be constituting what the court found and the officer observed was the wide turn, that it was unnecessary and there was no practicable obstacle or anything preventing him from making that left turn properly in this case.
Show me your picture again. So are there lines in there throughout? So when you make that left turn, there is a definitive road marker?
There are not lines in here, Your Honor.
Okay, so how do you know whether you're in the left or right lane?
I think Judge Stauber's talking about on the after the left-hand turn is completed. Is there a center line between those two lanes? Is that what you're asking?
I was looking up above. There's nothing up above, but there is then down below.
Okay.
Yeah. As in the lane, in the roadway being entered, are there lines? Was that the question? And I would assume there are, Your Honor. It is a two-lane road, and I believe that was the finding of the district court as well, that it was a two-lane road that he was entering.
Yeah, there's a lane here, marker here.
There's no lane markers through the intersection.
So you may not even, well, we'll talk about
okay.
that.
All right.
So again, if the court does find in this case that the district court did erroneously apply this in terms of whether it did not look at the terms of whether the vehicle was to the left of center of the intersection, I believe the remedy for that is remand. But I would also argue that the district court did make the finding that this was a wide turn. It didn't go into detail of what exactly constituted the wide turn, other than what the officer cited in his testimony, that it was based on the going into the right lane. But Tolvay versus Commissioner of Public Safety, 2007 case that this court decided, did state that a wide turn in and of itself is a legal basis for a stop. The Tolvay court did not analyze what the actual statutory requirements of such a turn are, but rather relied on the trial court record, which found the turn unusually and excessively wide based on the observations of the officer. And again, what we have here is unusually and excessively wide turn based on the time of night that the stop occurred, the location, and that there was nothing preventing the appellant from actually making the turn into the closest lane.
I didn't see in the transcript any testimony about unusually wide or excessively wide. It seemed like you were just talking, the officer was talking about, the court was talking about, and counsel were just talking about this statute.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. I'm just pointing out the language from that case on what they cited, and that.
But
would
it's not in the record here.
It is not in this record, Your Honor. So in conclusion, the state would ask that the trial court decision be upheld and that this statute be found in violation as a wide turn and that the district court opinion be sustained.
All right, thank you. Appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish to use that time.
Yes, Your Honor.
Judge Rodenberg, to address your parting question, from what I do know of Hyen, I would state that case simply doesn't apply here given the specific factual circumstances of this case, as well as Minnesota law that is to the contrary, which is cited in my brief, which is particularly State v. Anderson and State v. George.
Which were based on an independent state ground?
That's my understanding, Your Honor. As to the state's arguments, our common understanding of how a left turn should be conducted is meaningless and without any value in this analysis. What matters is what the statute actually dictates. And all that the statute dictates in terms of how a turn should be completed on the roadway being entered is that it be to the right of the center line. And that last clause that the state and the lower court relied on only dictates movement within the intersection itself.
There are a bunch of cases, though, that talk about wide turns as being indicative of intoxication, particularly right after the bars close and sufficient to warrant the stop, right?
That there is some case law that would support that, but there's an issue with that here in this particular case. One is that there is no evidence, there is no testimony that the officer saw turning into the far lane as evidence of impairment. All he testified to is that he believed it was a violation of state statutes. There's no evidence to support the argument that this turn was so wide that it created reasonable suspicion of impaired driving. Again, there was no testimony and there was no finding to that effect. Also, I would take issue with the fact that the state did not raise this argument in the lower court. The state has the burden to prove the constitutionality of evidence that it has obtained, and it presented no evidence of the fact that the officer felt this to be some indicia of impairment. And I think a similar issue arises with their claim that there needs to be some remand for a determination as to whether or not he was left of center of the intersection, if that is the appropriate reading of this statute, because they had a chance to create that record, but there is nothing in there. And again, it's their burden to supply the evidence and to show that this was all obtained constitutionally. So they should not get a second bite at the apple under those circumstances. And in the Tolvay case that they cite, I believe that they misread it. In Tolvay, what the Court of Appeals actually found was that the wide right turn in that case actually violated the right turn statute, the one that appears right before the provision that we've been talking about
today. Not completing it close enough to the curb.
Exactly, because that provision contains language stating that it shall be made as close as practicable to the right-hand curb or edge of the roadway. And what the Court of Appeals held was that by making that wide turn, it violated that specific provision of the right turn statute. We do not have a similar provision in the left turn statute, so a simple wide turn into the far lane does not create a sufficient basis to uphold the stop in this case. I would also note that the procedural posture of this case makes a remand impossible. This case came before this court on a stipulated facts trial for the purposes of appealing the pretrial issue. And as part of that process, the parties agreed that the pretrial issue of the interpretation of the left-hand turn statute was the controlling dispositive issue. And there
first remand is a disposition.
That is, yes, remand is a disposition.
It's dispositive. You can find it to be dispositive and still have the disposition be a remand.
Well, I would point your honors to State v. Yang, 814 Northwest 2nd, 716. It is a 2012 Minnesota Court of Appeals case that came to the Court of Appeals on a similar stipulated facts trial under the same rule of criminal procedure. And in that case, they found, based on a mistaken interpretation of a statute, that there was no basis to seize Mr. Yang and stop Mr. Yang in that case. And they held that a remand essentially is not available to either party, and an erroneous pretrial ruling results in outright reversal. That case has been cited approvingly for that proposition by this court since that time in a couple of unpublished decisions, the citations to which I could give the court if you desire. Again, in conclusion, Your Honor, the statute here is clear and it's unambiguous. And at no point does it dictate what lane a left turn must be completed in. That last provision that we're arguing about merely talks about movement within the intersection itself, and the only provision talking about the roadway being entered and how a turn must be completed merely says to the right of the center line. Mr. Kelly complied with all the applicable provisions of the statute in this case, and thus there was no legal basis for the stop of his vehicle. And the lower court ruling must be reversed, the evidence suppressed, and his conviction vacated. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. The matter is submitted. We'll issue our decision within 90 days, and we thank both.